All right, you're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and for the next hour, you will be listening to Radio Naturopath.
How about that?
If you want to.
Yeah.
I mean, I said you will as though it's a, you know, fait accompli.
Well, I will because I have my headphones on.
Yeah, I mean, you're planning to. But, you know, you're welcome to listen to Radio Naturopath for the next hour. We'd love it if you would, and we'd also love it if you would contribute. So the number to call in order to do that is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. You can text us at that same number, 860-486-9487, and you can also write us at radionaturopath@gmail.com. And I've got my Gmail right in front of me, and so I'll be happy to take your questions, just like Leslie did. Leslie wrote into radionaturopath@gmail.com, and she had a question for me. So she wants to know what to do for yourself or a child after a tick bite to try to decrease the chance of contracting a tick-borne illness. And so when she saw that a family member was testing positive for Lyme, they're watching and waiting for possible symptoms and wanted to know what I thought about that. And also, should antibiotic treatment be required at some point? And what do I suggest for managing the side effects of antibiotics? Okay, so that's a couple of questions there. So here's the thing. First of all, if you get bitten by a tick and then you get symptoms of Lyme disease, it doesn't matter if you have been tested or not. If you get bitten by a tick and then you are symptomatic of Lyme disease, a smart doctor will do a clinical diagnosis of your symptoms and say, yep, you were bitten by a tick, you've got Lyme disease. Lyme disease is a clinical diagnosis. I can't say that enough times. It's a clinical diagnosis. What the labs say is not as important as looking at you. And that's generally a good plan for anything. What the labs say is not as important as what's going on with the actual person. I mean, labs are a tool. You are a human being, and a good clinician is going to be able to assess the clinician, is going to be able to assess the patient, and use labs as a tool. In fact, when you talk about the Lyme Western blot, which is a test of various antibodies to Lyme disease, there are a lot of doctors who treat that as the gold standard if the patient has the requisite 2 IgM bands positive and 3 IgG bands positive. Then they'll treat them for Lyme, but if they don't have that, they won't. I don't agree with that practice at all. And when I was diagnosed with Lyme disease, of course, I had an erythema migrans rash. I had the actual rash of Lyme disease that was right where the tick had bitten me. And I didn't get a test for Lyme disease. My clinician looked at me and said, nice erythema migrans rash. Here, have these antibiotics. That was the right thing to do. A smart doctor will look at you and go, all right, what are your symptoms? First of all, if you've been bitten by a tick and there's an erythema migrans rash there, you've got Lyme disease. That's it. You get antibiotics. You could pay for a test, but there's no point because it doesn't matter. The test may be positive or negative. Why would that be? Because Lyme disease is very crafty. It has all kinds of ways to elude the immune system. It could turn itself into an L form. It can turn itself into a cyst. And so your immune system can't see it, so it can't make the antibodies to fight it. Also, Lyme disease can create colonies and put a big protein shield around it called a biofilm. And when the Lyme spirochetes are inside the biofilm, again, the immune system can't see it. So you might not get antibodies as a result of that. So antibodies should not be a litmus test for whether you have Lyme disease. A good clinician should give you a good clinical diagnosis and decide if you're symptomatic. If you are symptomatic, then you have Lyme disease. I also don't agree with the practice of giving somebody antibiotics for a prescribed period of time, and then when the patient is still symptomatic, stop treating them. You treat the patient until they are no longer symptomatic. If they are symptomatic, they still have Lyme disease. This idea that if somebody has the symptoms of Lyme disease, you give them 3 weeks of antibiotics and they are still sick, that they don't have Lyme disease anymore, in my estimation, is malpractice. That should not be done.
Ooh.
Yeah, it should not be done. If somebody gets bitten by a tick, has all the symptoms of Lyme disease, and 5 weeks out, they still have symptoms of the same exact symptoms, it's not something else. It's still Lyme disease, and you should be treating them. That's my opinion. And that is the agreed upon.
And if they didn't test positive?
Doesn't matter. Like right. I said, if they don't test positive, there are reasons why they don't test positive. Lyme disease eludes the immune system. And so there are ways that it can elude the immune system. Even conventional practicing doctors, some conventional practicing doctors understand that. And they'll say, well, it takes the immune system a while to respond. Just because you have a negative test doesn't mean you don't have it. So there are other tests, but they're not readily available. And I'm hoping that at some point these will be available to the general public and be covered by insurance. But right now, there are certain tests you can get that investigate for the DNA of Lyme to be present in your body. So it's different than what we do now from your ordinary labs where you're simply looking for antibodies to Lyme disease. And that's your current immune system responding to the Lyme that is present in your body. When you look for DNA, it's there. And it doesn't matter if the immune system is responding. You're looking for actual DNA evidence that the Lyme is in your body. And so there are a number of companies that will do that for you. And the only problem is that you usually have to pay out of pocket. They're not covered by insurance. But if you can manage to do that, it can be very telling. And they don't just test for Lyme disease. They test for other tick-borne illnesses as well. I have yet to convince a patient to do it because we live in northeastern Connecticut and not everybody wants to fork over money. People are used to using their insurance to pay for tests. And if they feel like it's not necessary to do the test, they won't do it. So I'm hoping at some point someone will do it. And in fact, I might do it on myself because I've had Lyme disease at least once. And I wonder if the DNA is still present in my body and if I have DNA of other tick-borne illnesses. I certainly know that I've been bitten by ticks. So I don't know. I've often thought that, you know, there's a few tests that I should be doing on myself just to get the information. Whether I decide to treat it or not, I like to use myself as a guinea pig. Do I remind you of a guinea pig?
I'm going to not be able to answer this correctly because I'm going to get in trouble no matter how I answer it.
So it's a three?
I believe it's a three.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Did you know that guinea pigs, you're not supposed to really have only one guinea pig when you have a guinea pig as a pet?
Well, they get lonely.
You got it.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. Guinea pigs are social creatures. So if you get one guinea pig, you should really get two. Maybe we should get guinea pigs.
Maybe we shouldn't.
Why? They're cute.
Who's going to take care of the guinea pig?
We are.
We?
Yeah.
We as in both of us?
Yeah.
As in you and I?
Yeah.
Kind of like we make dinner?
How about a snake? Would you like to get a snake?
I don't have a warm and fuzzy feeling about this.
About snakes? Snakes are cute too.
Well, pets in general.
How about a turtle?
Yeah, there you go.
I should keep talking about naturopathic medicine.
Yeah, then there's that.
I'll just throw out there that pets are good for you, and it actually doesn't matter what kind of pet. You can get a pet that you pet, or you can get a pet that's not even a pet that you pet, like a fish or a spider. Getting a pet of any kind is good for your health because you are caring for another creature and you're enjoying it and admiring it. And even if it's a fish, you're giving it positive energy and you're taking care of it. And people who, need help because if you feel lonely, getting any sort of pet will help you with that. It's better. You have better health if you have any kind of pet, and it doesn't matter what kind. You get the kind of pet that suits you. So,
and there's nothing like curling up on the couch with a fish.
Oh, dear.
Sorry, I had to go there.
All right. Okay. So anyway, so that's the thing. So that's about treatment. If somebody looks at you and says clinically you have Lyme disease, you're supposed to treat the person with antibiotics, or if not antibiotics, at least something else, until the person is well. That's what you're supposed to do. And if I had a script pad, which could happen at some point if we finally get prescriptive authority in the state of Connecticut, that's what I would do. And that's what naturopathic physicians do in other states. And that's what Lyme literate doctors do. So now Leslie reports that she was bitten by a tick. The tick itself tested positive for Lyme. So here's the thing. Now, I sat in a conference with Dr. Dardick, who is a physician here in Mansfield, and he's something of an expert on Lyme disease, and he said something very interesting that I really respected, and that was if you get the tick tested, you're going to find out that the tick had Lyme in it. That doesn't necessarily mean you have it, because if you pulled the tick off you in time, you may not have come down with Lyme disease, or if you have a really strong immune system, your immune system could well have chewed it up. So just because the tick tests positive doesn't mean you have it. However, in my estimation, there is a practice of when you get bitten by a tick, especially a deer tick, the kind of tick that carries Lyme disease, whether you know if the tick has Lyme or not, there is a convention of offering prophylactic antibiotics. So what you would do is you would go to your physician, a supportive physician, whether you went to the walk-in or whether you went to your PCP, and they can offer you a single 200 milligram dose of doxycycline. Doxycycline is the first antibiotic that is used to treat Lyme disease, and it's pretty effective. You know, if you, especially if you just caught the illness, you get, if you do a prophylactic dose of doxycycline, you may nip it in the bud. So that is a practice. And when my patients tell me I've been bitten by a deer tick, I will often suggest that they go and do that. They are certainly more than welcome to come to me and get some of my herbs. There have been, I don't know that there are the best studies on the herbal remedies that I use to help people with Lyme disease. I do like it, and Lyme disease is one of those things that, even though I'm a naturopathic physician, that a first-line treatment is antibiotic therapy, reminding you that naturopathic physicians are, we're not supposed to practice as us and them. We are integrative practitioners, and now there are some naturopathic physicians who will never use anything chemical or conventional medicine. That's not me, and that's not actually how we're trained. We are trained to use pharmaceuticals. Really, what naturopathic physicians do is we bring you the best of science and nature, and a good naturopathic physician, when you come in with your five pharmaceuticals that you're taking, they're going to look at them and go, oh, you're taking this for this, right? And you're taking that for that. Like, I see your list and I see that you're taking pantoprazole, and I know right away that somebody diagnosed you with gastroesophageal reflux, and perhaps you even have Barrett's esophagus, maybe, maybe not, but I know you've been diagnosed with reflux. If I see your lisinopril, I know that somebody thinks either you have high blood pressure or you have a heart arrhythmia. I know that if you're taking atorvastatin, somebody thinks your blood pressure is too high. And if you're taking Tricor, somebody thinks your triglycerides are too high. And if you're taking Cosentyx, then somebody thinks you have psoriasis. So I can tell. I mean, I can rattle those off. You know, I know my pharmaceuticals. And the unfortunate thing is that, as I said, in the state of Connecticut, we still don't have a prescriptive authority, and we are working on it. And if you want to help with that effort, please go. You can go to the CNPA website, the Connecticut Naturopathic Physicians Association website, and help with that effort. But naturopathic physicians would like to be able to work with antibiotics to help people with Lyme disease. And then, because right now, there's replication. You come in. Our doctors, our patients love us. They come in, they want us to diagnose them. We diagnose them, and then we can't prescribe them, and so they have to go somewhere else. And it's replication of care, and it's not necessary because we know how to diagnose them, we know how to treat them, and we can't. So hopefully that's going to change in the next few years. So anyway, if I had a script pad and the patient was amenable, I would prescribe that 200 milligram dose, prophylactic dose of antibiotics. Now, the next question that Leslie asked was, what do you do about the side effects of the antibiotics? Okay, so let's go there. First of all, doxycycline is an interesting antibiotic. It's very good at killing spirochetes. So spirochetes are a weirdo bacteria that they're called a spirochete because they have a spiral form. And they're hard to treat, and because they have that spiral form, they can burrow into tissues in your body. However, the tetracyclines, the class of antibiotics called the tetracyclines, of which doxycycline is one, are very good at taking out spirochetes, especially if they're in the spirochete form. Now, spirochetes can morph into other forms, like spirochetes can go into a cyst form, and doxycycline can't get those. You then have to give an antifungal, which will kill the cyst form. But for the spirochete form, which is what your Lyme is going to mostly be when you first catch it, you can get it with doxycycline, and you can get it with other tetracyclines as well. The thing with doxycycline is that it does make you sun sensitive. So if you've been given doxycycline, you want to use sunscreen, especially this time of year. And this, thank goodness we're getting some awesome, gorgeous taste-o summer in the next few days. I'm so psyched.
Isn't it great?
I'm wearing shorts and a t-shirt right now.
I am too.
Well, we're in the chilly studio.
And a sweatshirt over the top because it's air conditioning here.
Because in the chilly studio, I know.
Yeah.
Well, the machines that get hot.
I know.
Yeah.
I understand.
I know. So that's the first thing. If you're going to be given doxycycline or other tetracycline classes of antibiotics, you want to use sunscreen, even if you're just going to be going out in the car and going to and from work. Especially this time of year when the sun's pretty strong, you can get a sunburn through the glass of your car. So put on a sunscreen. It's a good idea. And I would say whatever the highest SPF you have around, 30, 50 would be fine. Because you really can get a sunburn a lot easier when you take the doxycycline. So the second thing, of course, is remember that thanks to my buddy Chandra, the quantum physicist, he says that the microbiome is driving evolution, and I agree with him.
What does that mean?
So the microbiome is all of the tiny flora, the bacteria, viruses, and fungi that are most of the dry weight of our bodies, and they are most of what's going on everywhere. I mean, how many people do you know that are ill because of mold intolerance? The microflora are really important, and so we have wonderful microflora called probiotics that live in our bodies. And when you take doxycycline is nonspecific. It doesn't just kill spirochetes. It doesn't just kill your Lyme disease. It kills a lot of stuff. So it's also going to kill the microflora in your body. One of the things you may find is even if you don't have a sinus infection, if you suffer from respiratory allergies, just seasonal allergies, when you take the doxy for your Lyme disease, you might find your nose feels a little bit better. Why? Because there are normal bacteria living in your nose, just like commensals, just bacteria that tend to live there anyway. And your doxycycline is going to kill them. I know the last time I took antibiotics for, I took it for a sore throat not too long ago. And then I took it when I was really, really sick with that bronchitis. My nose cleared up. Because I'm a little, I have a dust allergy and all that. But my nose got a lot better because there are bacteria that normally live in your nose. So whatever's in there is going to die. But also, your beneficial bacteria are also going to be killed, which means you give an advantage to things that can't be killed by antibiotics like yeasts. So when you're taking an antibiotic, it's a good idea to consume probiotics. Now, you can do that by consuming fermented foods. If you're not dairy intolerant, you can do dairy, but you have to keep calcium-containing foods a couple, like 3 or 4 hours away from taking doxycycline. So you can't do dairy right at the same time. But you can take a probiotic, and you can take lots of probiotic pills. The problem is you're kind of at cross purposes because the doxy is going to kill the probiotic that you've ingested. But if you take Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a probiotic yeast, so bear with me, it's a yeast, which just means a one-celled organism that reproduces by budding. It is not candida, which is that's the yeast that gives us problems in our bodies when it overgrows. It's a probiotic yeast that does wonderful things for our bodies, and it also eats up bad guys. So if you get an overgrowth of unfriendly bacteria or yeast, the Saccharomyces boulardii will outcompete it and will eat it. So Saccharomyces boulardii will make it so that you feel like you're not even on antibiotics, digestively anyway. So you take that while you're taking the antibiotics. And you can also take high doses of other, good bacteria. I know you'll be taking them and a lot of them will be killed, but then you take some more and you get some help for that. But if you take just a normal dose of Sac Boulardii, it can't be killed by the probiotics. So that will help you. So that's what you do.
Hmm.
Yeah. And when you're being treated for Lyme disease, even if you're being treated with antibiotics, it's a good idea to check in with your friendly local naturopathic physician because we have all sorts of stuff that can help you. adjunctively to your antibiotic therapy. We have herbs that can help. We have drainage remedies. We have things that support your liver, kidneys, and lymphatics. We want to talk to you about nutrition and rest, and how important it is, for example, if you have Lyme disease, how important it is to heat up your body and sweat, because when your body is hot, the spirochetes die. Your spirochetes want you to be cold. They want your body to hang out at a nice 98.6 or lower. Lower is better even. So because the Lyme will go after your thyroid too, and it'll make your temperature go down. So if you're cold, the Lyme is happy. If you get hot by sweating, whether in a hot bathtub or a sauna, or you just get good quality cardio exercise, spirochetes die. So athletes can tend to get through Lyme disease faster than other people if they're able to exercise, because they're speeding blood through their kidneys, liver, and lymphatics, and they're heating that blood up. So heat is good for you. And so if you can if you're having Lyme disease and you're already pretty athletic, getting a level of exercise that you can tolerate that heats you up is good for you.
Yeah, you just have to get healthy enough so you feel like you can actually get out and exercise.
That's right. And so if you can't exercise because you know you're too tired or you're in too much pain, of course you don't. So
in
that case,
it makes you feel awful when you get it. It just really, like, you lose everything, all your energy, everything.
Yeah. So in that case, if you're too weak to exercise, your body's telling you don't exercise.
Right.
In that case, you can still heat your body up by eating hot food, by eating spicy food, and by getting into a hot bath or a hot shower or a sauna or steam.
So what happens if you, for some reason, don't want to take antibiotics?
Yeah, well, that's controversial. Mm-hmm. I don't feel comfortable saying to somebody who I know has acute Lyme disease, don't take antibiotics. However, I have people say to me, I'm not going to take antibiotics.
I was wondering if you ran into that.
Of course. Mm. So I note it in my notes, does not want to take antibiotics. The patient has decided they don't want to take antibiotics because I have to cover my tush and send them to get antibiotics. And if they say, I'm not doing that, I want you to help me, I'm like, okay. So as long as I document it and say the patient declined to go somewhere and get antibiotics, mm-hmm. and then I go ahead and give them natural medicine. And I have all kinds of cool stuff that can help fight Lyme disease. And in any case, a lot of the docs are like, you know, they're going to give you 2 to 3 weeks of antibiotics, and then they refuse to give you more. And then one of the things I'll do is I'll ask the patient, who may still be symptomatic, I'll try to find them another doctor who's considered to be Lyme literate. Not everybody has the same access to Lyme literate doctors, because frequently Lyme literate doctors charge a lot of money and don't take insurance. So it's really scary, because one of the things that I see happening with Lyme disease is that good treatment for Lyme disease is based on ability to pay, which is terrible, which goes back to the whole, you know, we need one pay, you know, that we need everybody to have equal access to health care. And it's not right that, you know, only if you have money can you get good care for your Lyme disease.
Well, tell the Orange Man.
I can't tell the Orange Man anything. I don't think he would understand.
He's in a pile of you know what.
He
could use something positive.
I'm kind of hoping he's on his way out, but let's not go there right now.
Okay.
So I mean, of all the things that have happened lately, it's just like, I mean,
we're not going there.
I feel like getting my popcorn out.
Yeah, well,
because it's just amazing to watch.
Well, it's just the reality show has been moved to the White House. That's all.
It's not an appropriate place for a reality show.
I'm with you.
It should be fictional, like The West Wing. Or like Madam Secretary. Those are fiction.
But
this is stranger
than
fiction.
But we're not going there, right?
No.
No.
We're not.
No.
So I do definitely get people in who don't want to take antibiotics, so I treat them various ways. I'm a fan of certain brand of products that do drainage. So there are herbs that also have energetic properties that help to kill the spirochetes and get them out of the cells and get them moving. And there's various different herbs that will address Lyme, and we'll also address some of the co-infections like babesiosis and Bartonella. And then at the same time, you give compounds that enhance the function of the liver, lymphatics, and kidneys so that you minimize Herxheimer reactions. Herxheimer reactions being when you kill off bacteria, your body may not do a great job of getting the bacterial toxins out fast enough, and so you get symptoms from that. And so if you enhance the functioning of the liver, lymphs, and kidneys, then you'll have less symptoms from that Herxheimer reaction. If you do get a Herxheimer reaction, it's a good idea to stop taking the antimicrobials and just focus on the cleansing, because right now your body's got all it can handle of the dumping of the bacterial toxins. So it's a good idea to clear those before you continue to kill them. Yeah.
So I have in front of me here a list of the five most effective natural antibiotics.
Oh, okay.
You want to give an opinion here when I read them off to you?
All right.
Okay. Starting with number one, honey, two, garlic, three, myrrh, four, thyme, and five, oregano.
Okay. So, so you said the first one is garlic. Garlic is definitely
honey,
something.
Actually.
Oh, I'm sorry, honey. Mm-hmm. So honey is great topically. So if you have a cut, you can put honey on a cut. If you have a sore throat, that's why taking spoonfuls of honey or a cough or if you have a cold, taking honey, it's actually working locally. So the honey, it just starves it out. I think by covering it with all that sugar, and also just the nature of the polysaccharides, it just starves out the bacteria. It just can't go anywhere. And also there are bioflavonoids and antimicrobial compounds in honey. But I think it really works best topically, locally.
That's what I'm reading here. It also contains hydrogen peroxide.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So that's going to be part of its mechanism.
So that's going to have some of that.
Yeah.
Has a high sugar content,
right,
which can help stop the growth of certain bacteria.
Yeah.
And it has a low pH level.
Yeah. So it's acidic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so things that are acidic tend to starve out bad bacteria. Pathogens like an alkaline environment.
Mm-hmm.
So if honey's a little bit acidic, then you're providing an environment that doesn't really work for them.
And if possible, opt for raw Manuka honey.
Yes.
Mm.
Yeah. That's a little controversial. The Manuka honey has been studied to have incredible antibiotic activity.
You like it.
I like it. I do like it. The thing is, it comes from Australia and New Zealand, so
right,
it's not local. On the other hand, so what? But it works.
But it works.
But I also like to support my local honey growers, my local honey producers, and you get as local as possible, and then you don't have the carbon footprint, and you're still going to get a lot of benefit. I have also found that if I get raw local honey or really good quality honey,
mm-hmm,
that's produced by a local producer, it tastes so much better than the pasteurized stuff you get at the supermarket.
Oh, gosh, yes.
It has a flavor profile. It's kind of like the difference between drinking, industrial mass-produced coffee and, good coffee from a local roaster.
It's factory eggs and free-range eggs.
Oh, my goodness. The same thing. The honey, I don't care for honey. That's
grass-fed beef and the other
the flavor.
Mm-hmm.
Last night we had a piece of fish and the seasoning was good, but the fish itself was eh.
It was eh.
It was eh. Because
was
I think it was farmed salmon, and I really prefer wild salmon.
Mm.
If I'm going to eat salmon, I want to eat coho, I want to eat sockeye, and I want it to be wild.
Because
I like that gamey taste.
Yes.
And you don't as much.
Not as much.
But I really like wild sockeye or wild coho. That have been out in the wild, fending for themselves, growing strong muscles, and
the ones
eating
with the boxing gloves on.
Yeah. Well, and there's this beautiful dark pink color.
Oh, I know.
And that's because they're much higher in astaxanthin. The astaxanthin makes it that color, so they're much higher in antioxidants. So it's really better for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And so, herbal antibiotics. So you said.
Number two.
Yeah.
Garlic extract.
Oh, yeah, garlic, of course. So
garlic,
again, is a great antimicrobial. I had a friend who grew garlic and sold it, and he would eat not a clove, but a bulb of garlic a day.
And he was a distant friend.
Preferably. He smelled.
Do you know why people who eat a lot of garlic don't get sick?
Because who wants to be around them?
No one will get near them.
Not even the virus. Oh, right.
It's like putting up a force field, you know? Yeah. You've got like this defensive field around you because you smell really... Well, I mean, you may smell good. I don't know. Some people might like the smell of someone who has an overdose of garlic. We used to go to a little shoemaker in Norwich.
Yes.
And the second you walked in the door, all you could smell was garlic.
Yeah.
The guy just ingested, little Italian shoemaker, used to ingest garlic like it was candy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Right. Well, it's very hard to get sick, and garlic thins your blood. It helps with cardiovascular disease and blood pressure, and it's a great antimicrobial. It'll kill anything. It'll kill bad bacteria, and it'll kill yeast and fungus. And garlic is one of the things that's recommended to eat regularly to help prevent tick-borne illness. How well it works, if it works better than doxycycline, I don't know if that's been studied, but if you do garlic regularly, I think you're less likely to get sick from Lyme disease.
Yeah, it does say that if you're taking a medication that thins your blood, consult your doctor before using garlic as an antibiotic.
Right, yeah. Because garlic is a great antiplatelet aggregator.
It's also a thinner, right?
Yes, it is.
So you don't want to thin when you're already thinning.
That's right. Well, right. You have to be careful. Like if you're taking a warfarin or if you're taking one of the 10A inhibitors.
One of those things they advertise on TV every 10 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You have to be careful.
It also says you can apply garlic concentrate directly to a wound or blemish.
That's right. That's true, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's something that's going to work topically. It might burn a little.
I would think it would burn a little because, you know, if you just eat raw garlic, it's got a little bite to it.
That's right. Mm. But, like, if you have an ear infection, you can take an unnicked clove and stick it in your ear.
Seems like I was doing something for...
when you had an abscess tooth, sure, you can take a garlic clove and
put it on
an abscess.
You got to be real careful, though, because you can actually burn your gum with it.
Yeah.
So you have to be real careful.
Whether you nick it or not, you may not be able to leave it in there for too long.
Not for long.
No,
right.
Yeah, those isothiocyanates. Hmm. Yeah, the compounds that are in garlic, they're sulfur compounds. They have the element sulfur in them, and they're called isothiocyanates. And they're interesting, bizarre compounds that do all kinds of cool stuff. So, great antimicrobial.
I'll tell you, when I had that thing in my mouth, the abscess, I put the garlic in and it just took it away.
Yeah.
Got rid of it. It was great. I couldn't believe the difference. Okay, number three on your list of natural products for antibiotics, myrrh.
Okay.
Myrrh extract.
Myrrh. So, Comifora myrrh is a resin. And so, it's not... actually a plant. It's a resin from the plant. And there are numerous resins that are good for you. So myrrh is just one of them. Frankincense is another. And when you use frankincense, you use the... Well, actually, I'm not sure if that's true. Definitely myrrh, you use the resin. When you use poplar buds are full of resin as well. So it's that sticky stuff that comes off the plant. And anything with sticky stuff that comes off a plant, resins are antimicrobial, and they trap microbes in them, and they have antimicrobial substances in them. So when you get that sticky stuff, again, that's something that's going to work topically. That's going to be something that's going to work for a sore throat. And, myrrh is one of the ingredients in – so long ago at the National College of Naturopathic Medicine, when it was still called that, a bunch of hippies put together a formula called hemp. And hemp was an acronym. It wasn't, there was no actual hemp in it. It was an acronym for Hydrastis, Echinacea, Myrrh, and Phytolacca. Hmm. And so Hydrastis is golden seal, which will kill anything. Echinacea, of course, is immune tonic par excellence. Myrrh, as we just said, is a great antimicrobial and resinous. And then Phytolacca is poke root. And poke root is an excellent lymphagogue. You can't do too much poke root because in high doses it's toxic, and you don't do the berries at all. You do the root. But it's a great lymphagogue. It moves stuff through the lymph. So you use the myrrh. We like to use myrrh, especially when the person had a sore throat, but that whole compound will work very nicely for acute respiratory infections.
Apparently you have to be a little careful with it too because there's a few things here. If consumed in large doses, myrrh can cause heart problems.
Oh, right. Mm.
And if you ingest too much of it, You may run into a diarrhea problem.
Yeah, myrrh's not something I would use every day. I would use it acutely for, you know, for acute infections.
But it kills off like E. coli and other various things.
Right.
Candida albicans.
Great. Well, that's yeast. That's when you get a yeast infection. Yeah. So it's very good for that. Yeah.
And a few other things here, too, that I can't pronounce. So we're not going to go there.
Yeah.
Okay. Next on your list, thyme essential oil.
Thyme. Does anybody really know what thyme it is?
Parsley, sage, rosemary, and thyme.
Oh, boy.
Mm.
Yeah.
All that. Are you going to Scarborough Fair?
It's the thyme of the season.
Mm.
So, thyme. Thyme is one of the... I believe thyme is a mint. You can look that up. Is thyme a mint?
It's probably
a mint.
Might be.
A lot of the...
I don't have that in front of me.
Thyme family is, it's a mint.
It's a mint.
So
it looks
a lot of these, yes, it sure does. Mm-hmm. A lot of the high essential oil leafy plants are mints. Basil is a mint. I believe that marjoram and oregano are mints. They're all in that same family. And they're really high in essential oils. And they all have a similar family of flavor and taste profile. But the essential oils are lovely and antimicrobial, so thyme is one of them. And you said oregano as well. Oregano and thyme are similar in that way, and they kill a lot of the same stuff.
That's coming up. In a 2011 study, researchers tested the effectiveness of both lavender and thyme essential oil.
Yeah.
Both oils were testing in a pool of over 120 strains of bacteria.
Yeah.
The researchers found thyme essential oil to be more effective at killing bacteria than lavender essential oil.
Lavender's good for other stuff, though. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that I like to use lavender. Lavender is good for the spirit. When you smell lavender, it helps you to be happier, and it helps with trauma, and it helps with calming. Lavender's a great nervine, whereas thyme I don't think of as a nervine.
Okay.
Thyme is a great antimicrobial. It'll kill pretty much anything. It'll kill bacteria and viruses and fungus. And thyme is one of the, I think thymol, the essential acid of thyme, it might be one of the ingredients in like Vicks VapoRub.
Mm.
But I'm not sure if it is now or if it was one of the ingredients in Listerine. It's a great antimicrobial.
Mm. Yeah.
So thyme is something you can add it to your food and your food will last longer because it will inhibit bacterial growth in your food and it'll inhibit bacterial growth in you.
Yeah. It also says here that many all-natural household cleaners use thyme essential oil.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
because it's a great antimicrobial.
Yeah, and it's especially helpful against antibiotic-resistant bacteria.
Yeah. Well, you know what? So is oregano. So is berberine.
Yeah, they're
so
all
is
like
echinacea.
That.
Yeah. Well, of course they are, because the reason for that is because when you're taking an antibiotic, you're taking a single compound, and your bacteria can figure out a way to mutate away from that bacteria and not be killed by it. But when you're presented with thyme oil, there's hundreds of compounds in there. You know, it's not just one compound. It's a whole bunch of compounds. So the bacteria has to mutate away from a whole bunch of compounds in order to do that, and it just can't. You know, it's so herbals. You have a better shot at killing stuff with herbal compounds over the long term than you do with antibiotics. Because antibiotics, you're much more likely to develop antibiotic resistance. You know how many compounds there are in garlic? A bazillion. Lots and lots of them. And that's the other thing. If you could use numerous plants, garlic, thyme, oregano, rosemary, and they're all antimicrobial. So, you know, bacteria doesn't know which way is up.
Okay.
So if you consume those things regularly. And I should mention that if you eat a diet that's rich in fruits and vegetables and herbs and spices that are high in volatile oils, you're going to be less likely to get sick altogether.
Right.
Because they have all these antimicrobial compounds and phytonutrients in it.
So here's the disclaimer at the end. You know how they have a disclaimer at the end of all the drug ads?
Yeah.
And it goes on and on and on and on and warns you of, you know, basic things like death.
Yeah.
Well, people with high blood pressure or hyperthyroid problems shouldn't use thyme essential oil.
Hyperthyroid. That's interesting.
Yeah. So
it's a thyroid stimulant. On the other hand, perhaps people who are hypothyroid should use it.
Ah.
Yeah, so I'll have to look into that.
And hyper and hypo meaning which is which?
If you're hypothyroid, that means your thyroid is sluggish. It's going to slow down. Your metabolism is going to be slow. You're going to feel tired. Your immune system is not going to work that well.
Okay.
And
if you're hyper, you're hyper.
Yes.
You're all jacked, jacked up.
Right? And it's more of a hyperthyroidism is more immediately life-threatening than hypothyroidism.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because the thyroid controls your metabolism. So if your metabolism is running too fast, what the symptoms of acute hyperthyroidism, not you.
No.
The symptoms of acute hyperthyroidism are, they're life-threatening.
Oh.
Yes, because you get, your heart races, you can get a heart attack, you can get heart arrhythmias, you can have a stroke. So the biggest danger is cardiac. Because it's pushing your heart to overwork and work way too fast.
Oh, okay. Well, that wouldn't be good.
Yes.
Right.
So if somebody has thyrotoxicosis, it's a medical emergency.
Yeah. If I'm going to make my heart overwork, it's going to be
because I'm with hypothyroidism, and it's not technically overworking because you can exercise. That's different. But the when you're hypothyroid, the damage, it is also damaging, but it's damaging over the long term. And because you're not metabolizing properly, you can... There is a danger to that, and it can cause growth problems. It can cause you not to repair your body as well. It can cause fatty deposits to happen in places you don't want them, like in your heart and your heart valves. So long-term lack of care for hypothyroidism is also dangerous, but it's much more insidious and slow. But if you're acutely hyperthyroid, that's a medical emergency.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So number five, you ready?
Yeah.
This is it. Oregano essential oil.
Right, oregano. So oregano is similar to thyme. Again, oregano, I believe, is a...
It has carvacrol in it?
Yes, which will kill a whole bunch of stuff.
Mm.
Yeah, so oregano is also a mint.
Looks like a mint.
Yeah. And so, like I said, the mint's high in volatile oils. And oregano is, I love oregano. It's really nice to put in your food.
Oh, it tastes great.
And again, if you use all these essential oil containing plants, a lot of the mints, you're going to be less sick over the long term. Oregano will kill pretty much anything. It'll kill your viruses, bacteria. It's also a great antiparasitic.
I'm starting to see a pattern here, too. Yeah. If you take a look at thyme and oregano and different things like that, the Italian seasoning.
Yes.
Mediterranean food. You know
right.
how they keep talking about the Mediterranean diet being
sure.
really good for you?
Yeah.
Hello.
Well, first of all, they taste good and they're flavorful. Second of all, they're beneficial for your health because the volatile oils do a couple of things for you. One is that they are antimicrobial. Another interesting thing about the volatile oils is they tend to be what are called carminatives. Carminatives are herbs that help you with gas.
Excuse me?
Yeah, they help you with gas. Mm. So if you're gassy, carminative herbs help with that. And the way that they do that is the volatile oils are a little irritating to your digestive system. And so they stimulate peristalsis. So you're more likely to move gas through you faster. So if you take some fennel or anise or oregano, basil, thyme, all of those things have carminative properties. The essential oils irritate your digestive system a little bit, and your digestive system goes ooh 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 ooh, so it contracts better, and you're going to move that gas out of you faster. Whereas there are some things like simethicone, I told you about simethicone before, that it surrounds the gas bubble, so it actually lubricates it, so it will come out of your body easier.
Well, now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right. So those are good things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's what I found. Let's see, was there something else I was going to bring up to you?
All kinds of stuff.
There's lots of stuff. There's tons of stuff.
Well, one of the things I want to talk about, there's a couple of things. Let's do a little piece on, we can spend the next few minutes on natural medicine backlash. Because I keep getting some things come through my Google feed and some of my some articles that I see that are sort of anti-natural medicine. So, for example, here's an article: what your alternative health provider might not tell you about megadosing supplements. Here's another one: supplements not as safe as they may seem.
Yeah.
Here's another one. An article came across my desk there was a couple that fed in somewhere in Europe. They fed their child a gluten-free diet, and the child died.
Not from gluten-free.
Hello. I mean, and so articles like that
are... So what did the child die from?
They're clickbait. This is sort of clickbait. So the thing is, your alternative...
Clickbait, I like it.
What your alternative medicine provider might not tell you about megadosing supplements. If your alternative medical practitioner isn't discussing the possible side effects of supplements with you, there's a problem. Also, I have a meme that I use, and that's anything can cause anything in anyone. If a patient comes to you and says, when I eat quinoa, I jump up and down and stand on my head, you have to honor that and believe them. And you have to find out if they want to jump up and down and stand on their head. And if they do not, you need to not only instruct them to not eat quinoa, but help them with that side effect. It doesn't matter. If a patient comes in and tells you, I have this symptom and I think it's because of this, even if you don't think it's true, you have to honor that, because anything can cause anything in anyone. We have biochemical individuality, and you don't know what polymorphisms people have, what genetic individualities people have. And if people are very sensitive, even something that you think is benign, like magnesium, can set them off. If you give them the wrong magnesium salt, or if they have a polymorphism that if you relax them too much, or they're just really, or you give them a magnesium and they have a detox issue, and you give them magnesium is now being a cofactor to some of their detoxing enzymes and they detox too fast, you have to honor that. And so if you go to a practitioner and the practitioner doesn't have good oversight of what you're taking, or you don't communicate what's going on with you, there can be a problem.
You should always bring a list with you.
Just like those MDs. And so this is amazing to me, where you're like, what your alternative health provider might not tell you about megadosing supplements. I could fire that right back at the MDs. What your MD might not tell you about those pharmaceutical meds that you're taking.
Right.
Really. I mean, the side effect profiles of the pharmaceutical medications are incredible.
It's terrible.
Right. And so, and yet MDs feel quite comfortable providing pharmaceutical medicines that have really scary side effect profiles all the time.
I particularly like the ones that lead to death.
And having said that, that doesn't mean that you won't get side effects from supplements. You absolutely can. And this article here talks about one case where somebody didn't have good oversight of their patient overdosing on vitamin B6, and the person got neuropathy. Now, how many people do you know that that happened to? Versus how many people do you know that have taken a pharmaceutical medicine and had a side effect from it? I could give you the answer to that. It's very unusual to see somebody overdose on vitamin B6. But if that really happened... that natural practitioner didn't have good oversight over that patient. And we know that if you take too much B6, on the one hand, if you have some neuropathies, high-dose vitamin B6 can help. But if you take too much of it, you can get a neuropathy. And so you have to have oversight on that. They're dissing infusion centers, places where you can go to get IV vitamins. Some people benefit from IV vitamins. Like if their digestive system is very compromised, Meyer's cocktail is something that's been used for many years. It's got a number of vitamins in it, and you infuse it directly. This is making it sound like if you hear too much of these A, D, E, and K, the fat soluble vitamins, they can be harmful to you. Well, yeah, so can lisinopril. Again, if you have a good practitioner, they're going to have some oversight on that.
And the other thing here is, as I'm kind of perusing through this too, as we're talking about it, if you go to your doctor and you don't bring in a list of what you're doing,
right,
that's not such a great idea.
No,
you know,
not.
Your doctor will be jumping up and down for joy if you come in with a list of everything that you do.
Because I have so many people who come and they're saying, I'm taking... let's say I'm taking black cohosh, an herb for menopause. Oh, okay. What black cohosh are you taking? I don't know. What brand is it? I don't know. Is it extract or whole herb? I don't know. I'm like, will you please bring me the bottle next time? Okay.
There you go. There you go.
So we encourage.
So do you have people come in with bags?
Yes.
Filled, yeah?
Absolutely. The
people, that's a great thing to do.
You know, I hug and kiss the people with the bags. Well, not literally. But yes, we tell them that. When we're making the appointment, the initial appointment, we say if you have supplements and medications you're taking, please bring them in. Some people opt to bring their bags in, which I really appreciate because then I can see exactly what they're taking. I can tell them if it's a decent supplement or not. And some people will photograph them. They'll bring me photographs of it because it's so easy to take pictures of stuff now.
That's what I did for my eye doctor.
Yeah.
Because he asked me, what are you doing that's made this all of a sudden get a lot
better?
So
you don't have to schlep it and you just take a picture and show it to me on your phone and I'm happy to look at it. That works too.
It's good.
So here's another one, supplements not as safe as they seem. So that's total clickbait. And my concern there is somebody's going to look at that and go, all right, I shouldn't take any supplements ever at all. When there's so much good research on various supplements for certain conditions. And if you discourage somebody from taking supplements, you might be preventing them from doing something that can be really good for their health. And I can turn that into pharmaceuticals, not as safe as they may seem.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right? So
and that's becoming more and more of
so
an awareness,
it's true that
issue.
What they say is true, that manufacturers aren't necessarily required to post possible side effects of supplements. But that is why you go to a qualified natural medicine practitioner. Naturopathic physicians are very schooled in what could potentially happen. If you read this article and you don't have a lot of knowledge about these supplements, you might say, oh, they're all bad for me. I'm not going to take any supplements at all. And they give you examples of supplements that have been known to adversely affect liver metabolism, like echinacea. Echinacea is highly, highly safe, and if you're being overseen by a good herbalist or practitioner, they can help you with that. Kava, that doesn't talk about the fact that the problem with kava is that people were, this is something you would only know if you were really, you know, in deep into understanding of herbalism. The kava problem was that they were transporting kava, that people were harvesting kava, and to save money, they were using the above ground parts of the kava plant. So they were using leaves and twigs and twig bark, and you're not supposed to use that. You're supposed to use kava root. You're more likely to get all the side effects if you use the above ground parts. That's not there. They say cinnamon and then melaleuca, and of course melaleuca is spelled wrong. So it shows you how much you know. So the thing is, it's not that supplements are completely safe. That would be incorrect to say that supplements are completely safe. But to scare people out of taking them at all, I think is that's unethical. I don't scare people out of taking pharmaceuticals at all because there are some pharmaceuticals I really want people to take in appropriate situations. But you have to understand that it's not an us and them thing. And don't make these articles so that there's an us and them thing. Don't do that. Don't use that natural medicine. It makes me feel like you have an agenda. And if your agenda is to diss natural medicine, well, shame on you. Natural medicine is helpful for people, and there's good research on it. I don't like things that I can't prove scientifically. And I think science is also about observation. It's not just about, you know, double-blind placebo-controlled studies. It's also about clinical observations. If you see something go right in your office, you're likely to replicate it, regardless of what kind of practitioner you are. It's going to work in some people. It's not going to work in every person. But as a practitioner, that's part of the art of medicine. And if anybody tells you medicine is pure science, they're lying. It's not true. Medicine is an art as well as a science because in order to help people with their health, you have to talk to the people. And talking to people in a diplomatic and communicative way is an art. So you have to have good skills in communicating things and you have to kind of sell people on doing things that are going to be good for their health. And that's not exactly science. I mean, it sort of is, because if you talk to people in certain ways, it's going to be more helpful than others. But knowing what to do in each situation, you have to be on your toes all the time, because mm-hmm. you never know where people are going to go emotionally. When you are looking at a human being, you're looking at a universe, and you never know what's going to come out of them when you're sitting in consultation with them.
Sure.
And so even if you're trying to convince them to take hydrochlorothiazide, a diuretic for their blood pressure, some people you're going to have to convince them, and you have to say it in a way. You have to build their trust, and that's not direct, you know, double blind placebo-controlled science. That's the art of your communication.
Right.
So dismissing, what I don't agree with is dismissing supplements and natural medicine out of hand. And there are some belief systems that do that. They just dismiss all natural medicine. If it's natural medicine, it's wrong. And I think that's an emotional response. It's not scientific. And it means you have an emotional agenda that has nothing to do with science. And I believe in body, mind, and spirit, balancing all of those things. Let me see. There was another one that kind of annoyed me here.
Yeah. Think I sent over a link to try to annoy you.
Yeah, thank you.
Get you fired up.
Yeah, that's right. Supplements not as safe as you they seem. Does hydrotherapy really work for exercise recovery?
What your alternative health provider might not tell you about megadosing supplements?
Yeah, I already did that.
I did that.
I talked about that one.
Not as safe as they seem.
Yeah.
You did that one too.
Right. Okay. So I'm going to click on this, should you see an energy healer? Because I'm curious.
Hmm.
I want to see where they go with that. And if they say, don't do it, I'll be annoyed. Okay, so let's see where they're at with that. This looks like, all right, so this is, I don't know that this article is, here we go, it's broken up. There's no universe. I think this article is probably somewhat positive.
I think most of these are. So I'm fumbling
this
through them
okay.
here.
This one is okay.
They talk about cupping, and they talk about flotation therapy and all sorts
okay.
of interesting things.
So that they're not too negative about that.
No.
I know what I wanted to talk about, and I don't only have a few more minutes, but I wanted to talk about the gluten meme that there was an article that came out where a couple had fed their child a gluten-free diet and the child died.
Right, right.
So that's ridiculous.
That is.
When you eat gluten-free, you thrive. When
that's
I eat gluten-free, I thrive.
And almost everyone I know who's given it a try say they feel better from it.
Yes.
Whether they're, you know, whether they're allergic to it or not, they
so
seem
what,
to feel better.
What goes on is what people don't realize. It depends on what else you eat.
Right.
When people say gluten isn't everything, how come not super skinny and I eat gluten free and I go days and days and days without eating any gluten at all? I mean, once in a while I eat einkorn.
Yeah.
I did have that peanut butter bar from the place. But I didn't get sick from it. But
yeah.
I'm not going to do that every day. But I don't have the problem like you have with the 20 parts per million. Like you can't eat bulk nuts.
You know, I had problems with those nuts we bought in New York also.
You did.
I did. Yeah, I am
okay.
just like crazy
you're wicked sensitive.
Yeah.
Right, and I'm not that sensitive. So if you stay away from gluten, you thrive. And the thing is, most of the time I eat no gluten either. And again, I'm very healthy and I can do cool stuff on my bike and I'm not sick. And the thing is, when you say gluten is everything, obviously you're not eating enough fruits and vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
You're not eating gluten-free whole grains. You're not eating, you know, starchy tubers. You're not eating, you know, healthy meats and poultry and fish. And
sounds like you're eating a lot of bread.
Right. So if you're overstarching,
there's the first problem.
And all you eat is starch, that's not good for you whether you're gluten-free or not.
Right.
If you're overeating starchy products, you know, wheat that are made from wheat versus gluten-free products that are made from wheat, and you're not eating produce and, not eating whole foods that are not that, then you're going to be nutritionally deficient. Mm-hmm. So it is possible that if you eat, you know, fortified whole wheat versus gluten-free counterparts, and that's all you eat, that you're going to be sicker if you eat the gluten-free versions of those things. And I, like you said in that article, what else did that kid have going on? If the kid died,
right?
That, I mean, and what did they actually feed that? No, it's not the whole story.
Alternative news.
It's alternative news. Yeah. So the thing is, there's people have a lot of fun, and comedians have a lot of fun making fun of people who are gluten-free. We went to School of Rock this weekend, and there was a little boy, the little boy who was the piano player, who was kind of a geeky nerd, who was the piano player, and he went, "I'm gluten-free," and that was in addition to his weakness.
And everybody chuckled in the
audience. Everybody chuckled. Yeah. Exactly, because being gluten-free is funny.
Well, no, it's not.
I know. For people who really need to be gluten-free, they really need to.
Spend a day with me after I eat gluten, and I'll let you know.
I'd rather not. And, we need, you know, sprays for the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. That's where the lavender oils come in and the peppermint oils
come in. Yes. And orange.
Orange and anything else.
Anything else, yes. And
clear the air with, so to speak.
Yes, exactly. Right. So, I mean, I think this meme of making fun of gluten intolerance is a little... it's up there with rejecting natural medicine out of hand. It's mildly annoying. And, there are problems with modern wheat that are real. And a lot of people who avoid modern wheat feel better. And they feel better even if they're not gluten intolerant. Like, I don't have the same kind of gluten intolerance you do, but I eat einkorn and I'm fine. You probably would not be fine if you ate einkorn.
I'm not going to try.
No, I don't think you should.
It's not worth it.
So there you go. All right. Well, you've been listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, and you have been listening to Radio Naturopath. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, you can listen at WHUS.org to our podcast at any time. You can also listen at my Facebook page, Fran Storch ND, Naturopathic Physician, Radio Naturopath. You can also listen on iTunes to Radio Naturopath. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back live in 2 weeks with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.